Welcome. This is my radio announcer voice. Sometime between Wednesday, my session on Wednesday, and Wednesday night, I lost my voice. So through the power of Microsoft accessibility options and PowerPoint, I've come up with a creative way to deliver this presentation. Oh, wrong one. This one here. Okay, we'll stop it there. No, I'm not going to do that. I just wanted to see if there was a reaction or if people really thought I was going to do that. For some of you, it might actually be the first session of the day. It looked a bit empty for the first session, so it sounds like a lot of people had a good time last night. If this is your first session of the day, hopefully my voice won't send you to sleep. And hopefully you'll get a lot out of this session. So my name is Brendan Byrne. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft Services, based here in Auckland, as you've probably just read. I've also got, I'm supposed to have a couple of customers, but one is in Australia, had to leave yesterday. So, but I've got James Chapman here from New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, and I was going to have Dan Bowden from Xero. But like I said, unfortunately he's not been able to make it. So, what are we going to cover today? My last session was more of a technical session, just kind of, in some ways it was just a brain dump of all the stuff that we've learned over all our engagements. Hopefully it would help you in some of the technical stuff that you're doing. It wasn't a demo fest or anything like that. This is not a demo fest. This is more about making sure that, you know, as far as the session objectives are concerned, that first of all we identify the similarities and differences with deploying Windows 10 compared to, you know, maybe some Windows 7 deployments that you've done. Also, making sure that you're getting value out of your investment in Windows 10. Put their bag down there. It's me. So making sure you get the most out of your investment with Windows 10. And also making sure that you're fully aware of all the capabilities and why you would enable them. And make sure you investigate all paths to the Windows 10-dom. There are multiple ways to get there. There's different goals and drivers that you might use to determine how you get there. But I just want to make sure you're aware of all those things. Now, I'm not going to go into a great amount of technical depth with any of the technologies that we'll discuss today when we look at some of the considerations. But it's more for yourself to ask, okay, have we thought about this? And you'll get an understanding why I'm taking this approach as we kind of go through. So let's get started. So the first thing, yes, I was gonna have a MacBook Pro up there, but it was just like, meh. Okay, right. So I love that thing. It's a bit too expensive for me, and I'm not creative, so I'd be kind of just doing all doodle art on it, and probably wouldn't be worth the investment. But it was definitely something that's a lot of people are talking about. So what are we going to cover in this session? We're going to cover the key drivers behind, you know, why you're wanting to get to Windows 10 and the approach that you might take to get there. We're going to look at the 80-20 rule, okay? I'll explain that more in a second. Then I'm going to go through the considerations. Have you considered these things when you've started in your planning for the Windows 10 rollout? Now, just so I've got an understanding here, how many people are partners in here? Okay, so there's a couple of partners. So how many people here are customers? So I would hope that everyone else is, right? So this is kind of what I wanted as far as the audience was concerned. I wanted to make sure that you as customers understand what the process is and what the things that you need to be thinking about when you deploy Windows 7. You know, have you covered it in your planning, or, you know, maybe not? And then we'll hear from James, and I'm going to present on behalf of on Dan, just around the different approaches that were taken and why they did them and the benefits they got out of them. So that's kind of what we're going to cover. So what is the key driver? Generally, there's kind of two key drivers. We just want to get to Windows 10 as fast as possible. Yeah, we're aware of those other those other capabilities, you know, credential guard and stuff like that. But, you know, we just want to actually get Windows 10 there as quickly as possible, and we'll deal with those other things later. The second kind of driver is actually there's some things in that, you know, some capabilities that we actually want to enable now. You know, we've got PIN, you know, with BitLocker, and we want to enable secure boot as part of that so we can get rid of PIN. You know, so maybe that's a driving factor about, you know, the process that you actually take to get there. Now, that second approach often gets a bit cloudy, and the reason being is yourselves and as the customers, you might have just read through some articles, or maybe you've you know, been talking to some people. Maybe you haven't been fully aware of all the capabilities, so you haven't been able to make a decision based on all those capabilities. So if you don't know what you don't know. So the idea is making sure you understand what those considerations are, take them into account, and then build your plan for deployment from there. So deja vu, I get this all the time. I'd be a millionaire if I got a dollar for every time I've heard this. We've already started deploying Windows 10. You know, we've created the image, we've deployed it using Config Manager, we've tweaked the UI a little, and you know, we've added some new group policies. For me being a Microsoft consultant and understanding the breadth of Windows 10, for me that isn't Windows 10 to its fullest capabilities. So I always have to ask the question, and this is where the 80-20 rule comes in. Most of the tasks that you will use to get from Windows 7 to Windows 10 are pretty much the same. So the image creation process, you know, you still might use tools like MDT or whatever you're using to create your image. Okay, you might replace your Windows 7 media with Windows 10, and maybe you turn some other features on and off, but generally the process is relatively the same. Maybe you add that script which can remove some of the Windows 10 apps, but you know, that's just a 10-minute, 15-minute task. The deployment of the image. So if you're using Config Manager, for instance, you could still be using Config Manager 2012 R2 and be able to deliver Windows 10, probably with a similar task sequence that you use to deliver Windows 7. So that hasn't changed that much. Deployment of applications, that hasn't really changed. Maybe as part of the process you've decided, yes, we're going to use self-service now, and because we're using self-service, we're going to do a user-targeted model, but you could have used a user-targeted model if you're doing Windows 7 as well. So it's not really a Windows 10 thing. So that is pretty much the same. Software updates, you can just recreate what you've done with Windows 7 for Windows 10, and that will work. The general management of the OS through your tool like Config Manager, that is generally the same. Whether it's inventory, whether it's software metering, or whatever the case is, not much has changed there. Group policy, yes, there's some new group policies, but how you do it is pretty much the same. If you look at the project approach, so if there's project managers you know, in here, you still go through a planning phase. You still go through a build slash remediation phase where you might have to get, you know, certain services up to a point to be able to deliver and manage. Then you get into some kind of alpha pilot, and then you go off and do the full migration. So that doesn't really change if you're doing a traditional deployment. Application compatibility testing is pretty much the same, but as I'll talk about soon, is different. So that's the 80% of the work that you probably have to do is you will be familiar with. Now, when I come into organisations and I work with organisations, often I'm just there for the 20%. I'm just there to make sure that those 20% of the new features have been taken account for, and make sure that, you know, if there is another way of getting to Windows 10, at least you've taken it into consideration. Whether you take the new path or continue with the traditional, that's fine, but at least you've been presented with the benefits and the drawbacks, and then you've been able to make an informed decision. So what's the difference? Yes, it looks like Windows 10 to me. So if I went and used that same process and you got a machine on your desktop, you'd probably go, yes, I've got Windows 10. And yes, you're right. You are right, but it is more of a Windows 7 version of Windows 10. So while yes, you have a lot of the components there in the background, and while you have a new UI, the process that you've used is more exactly the same as what you might have done for Windows 7. Have you identified those benefits that can be realized by enabling some of those capabilities? Do you actually know what those capabilities are? So whether it's the internal team that are doing this process, or whether you engage with a partner, the idea is this information, this is, okay, how are we going to adopt Windows as a service? Rather than just like, okay, we'll get Windows 10 in, and then it's just there. And then all of a sudden, the branch is becoming end of life, and then you start thinking about what the process is. Okay, so it's just ideas like that. You know what those capabilities are. So just challenge them. Okay, have we talked about this? Have we talked about this? And then you'll feel confident that, you know, all these things have been taken into consideration. Some things are done differently. So in some ways you can go with the status quo, you can go with the way you've always done it, but some things are different and you need to have taken account of that and be aware of those things. Sometimes this is where that key driver can come in. If you've decided, I just want to get to Windows 10 as fast as possible, and that process is really using the in-place upgrade, which one of our customers did, and it was extremely successful, then some of these things you don't have to worry about upfront, but you still have to consider them and have a roadmap of going, okay, right, for the time being we're going to put Windows 10 out there. Yes, it is going to be the Windows 7 version of Windows 10, but we've got a plan in place to turn on all these other capabilities because they actually do make sense for our organisation, whether it's from a productivity point of view or whether it's from a security point of view. I've always said, yeah, that's 20% is where I spend most of my time. Often, we have an offering called the Windows 10 Enterprise Pilot, where we go in, we help customers do a pilot of Windows 10. It's generally myself working with the customer, okay? I don't do a lot of the hands-on stuff. You know, so if there's 15 devices that need to be supported in your environment, we might just have 5 in scope. The first couple I will kind of use it as teaching. The last 3 will be just me viewing you guys doing it, and if it's all successful, you go off and do the other 10. So it's more of a knowledge transfer type scenario. And that has some decision leading workshops in it right up front, but I always add in, and I've got customers in here that I've actually done that for, where I always kind of go and add the Windows 10 overview and just make sure that everyone is aware of all those capabilities, because again, you don't know what you don't know. And if we haven't talked about it, then it's not going to be in your plan to be enabled. Once you get on this, now I used an analogy of a train, like railway tracks, and you're speeding towards the end of the track, and maybe that was just a bit too overboard, because it's probably not like that. It's more some of this, you know, safety features, you know, stop, you know, once you kind of get to end of support. But once you kind of get on this train, and you're on this Windows as a service journey, in future your projects will be small enablement projects. So we'll bring out anniversary updates, and Windows Information Protection is now released. And you've heard about it, and you thought, great, we've got a wider information protection strategy that's going on, and Windows Information Protection is part of that. So rather than going, okay, right, next version of Windows, big project, everything like that, it will be a small project, which is, okay, we want to enable that feature. So that's kind of where we're heading as far as projects once you actually get on this journey. So let's revisit it. Want to make sure that your conversations about deploying include these considerations. So I'm going to go through some of them now. Pardon me. And you know, these are the ones that you need to be thinking about. So if you're engaged with a partner, you need to make sure that you're talking about these things. If you're doing it yourselves, then you're looking into it. Or you're engaging someone that can come in and help you discuss these things. If you're already there, if you're in that scenario and going, oh, you've got Windows 10, but it's the Windows 7 version, don't worry about it, okay? It's just a matter of now you know, start planning for it. Many customers are in that situation. But I just want to highlight those considerations so you can think about it and start the roadmap to getting to the point where you're making the most of Windows 10 now and in the future. Yep, and again, we want to make sure you get the most out of your investment. So what are all these considerations? The key considerations. We want to make it safer and secure, more secure. We want you to be more productive. We want it to be more personal. We want it to be, you know, enabled to use powerful modern devices. These were all the investments. No, this is a marketing slide. But these are all the investments that we talk about. And to be honest, that first one, we could probably spend multiple sessions, you know, talking about just the security side. When I actually do these overview ones, we kind of rush through a brief overview and deployment and image creation and management. You know, that's all done in a day. The second day is on security. You spend half a day just talking about security. And the next one is Windows as a Service. You actually spend a majority of your time talking about those two things, because that is where a lot of the investment has been made. So yes, it might sound familiar, but are you making the most of those investments? So if we kind of, pardon me, let me just clear my throat. Oh, that's not good, is it? Okay, so security, modern security threats. You've probably seen this quote if you've gone to any of the security kind of sessions. There's two types of organizations. There's the ones that have been hacked, and the ones that they don't know they've been hacked. I also work with advanced threat analytics, which is all about identifying identity theft. So it kind of sits on the network, it looks at the ports on your domain controllers, does some port mirroring, and it can identify things like pass the hash and pass the ticket and golden ticket and skeleton key attacks and everything like that. And the presentations are really in-depth because they're all security-focused, and people start freaking out when they start realizing, you know, what people can do. But before we turn it on, one of the main things we ensure that we do is we take them through the security response plan, you know, to make sure that when we do turn it on, if all of a sudden there's all these big red flashing lights because, you know, they have actually been hacked but they didn't know it, then they've got a process to actually deal with it. Otherwise, it's kind of all a shock to them, and everyone's running around like headless chicken, trying to sort it out. If we look at the evolution of attacks, it started off with people doing mischievous stuff. So, how many people are kind of remember the slammer and blaster days? There's a few people that remember it. It was more around mischief. It was, yeah, I can get a script off the internet and I can just run it, and you know it's going to flood the network and cause all kinds of problems with services and stuff like that. But the motive was mischief. When we kind of get from 2005 to the present, in many cases it is around profit. So whether it's organized crime, whether it's just one person that's doing it, or whether it's a group of people that are specifically going out and targeting people, often it is around. It is around profits and things like ransomware and identity theft and stuff like that. And even today, this is what I had in my email. I haven't had one of these for ages. For some strange reason, it got through the Hotmail filters. People asking me to just click on a link because there's an unusual activity on my PayPal account. But, you know, the email address it's coming from is hotmail.com. So I doubt that has anything to do with PayPal. But, you know, if you went in and looked at the amount of this that is actually being prevented from coming into your organisation, you'd be astounded. We just get the odd few that come through. If we go from about 2012 beyond, all of a sudden it's nation states, it's terrorist groups, it's activists, and it's more about high-level disruption. It's about IP theft, damage, all those type of things. And there was just an article that I had taken a clip of. It was just talking about kind of this situation in the South China Sea between China and, you know, some of the other countries around there and the US coming in and the likes. And it was just talking about the fact that the next, you know, major war is going to rely, is a significant part of it is going to be cyber warfare. You know, you've got all these very complex devices. You've got these soldiers which have got video cameras and GPSs and stuff like that, and you know, all this kind of communication that's going on. It's highly digitized and computerized. you know, if you can attack that and put that down, all of a sudden, you know, people are just lost as far as, you know, the way they might approach those situations. But as far as the anatomy of attack, this will be common. Now, if I said Cryptolocker to you, I'm not sure whether you go, oh yeah, we've had Cryptolocker. But this is generally how it happens, and I see it a lot. There's customers in here who've had this, and I'm not going to look at any of them because you might think I'm talking about you, but I'm probably talking about most of them. You have a healthy computer. They receive the email just like I receive that PayPal email. The users are kind of lured to this website where they click on a link, and some software is installed on the machine. And generally, this software is installed in your local user profile where you can just, you know, have freedom to write. Right, so that might be OneDrive for Business, does it? Google Chrome does it. That's the only way that in the enterprise they could make sure they got a footprint. Let's let people install Google Chrome directly into the user profile, and then, you know, those UAC prompts which are hindering us will, you know, be circumvented. And usually what happens, pardon me, is the user will kind of install the software, and then they'll get all these prompts. And then our last barrier, which is UAC, kind of kicks in and asks for credentials. So they ring the help desk and say, I'm getting this thing every day. What do I do about it? So the help desk person comes on and they go, oh, right, I see. Well, actually, what I'll do is I'll enter my credentials, which has local domain admin, local admins on the PC, and I'll just see what it's doing. Enter. Okay, all of a sudden, maybe Cryptolocker is running. Maybe they've injected something into the operating system, which is just sitting there waiting to see if they can find better credentials. So maybe they've just got those local admin credentials. They're just going to sit there. They're going to sit there, and they're going to sit there undetected until the point when, domain admin logs onto that machine. Oh, now I have the hash of a domain admin. I'm going to inject that into my hash, and then I'm going to go out and I'm going to access anything that a domain admin can access. And what can a domain admin access? Pretty much everything. And you get to the point where you are owned, and you may not even know it. And that's why advanced threat analytics is something that is actually gaining a lot of traction, because people just don't know that they've been owned. And it's not until they have some data leak or something like that they actually have to go back and find out how this happened. But it is very hard to actually, if you ask your IT department, can you find out if we've got any past the hash or past the ticket hacks going on? They go, how would I do that? So hence, advanced threat analytics, not part of Windows 10, but part of the stack. So what do we do? We ruin the attacker's attack model. We make it so it's not profitable. We break the playbooks. So if we put something in place, some technology in place, which means, okay, now you can't do those normal attacks which have been so successful in the first place, now they have to go find some other way. And most of them aren't that intelligent. Most of them are actually people that just go on YouTube and try to find out, you know, what hacks they can do without actually being some kind of genius. And then we also eliminate the attack vectors. So if we look at Windows 7, we've got things like Windows updates, we've got Windows Firewall, we've got Smart Screen, we've got BitLocker. You know, these are just common things that are on there. Maybe you've got some of these things enabled, maybe you haven't. Okay, if we go to Windows 10, all of a sudden there's all these other things that drop down. And I'm going to briefly cover some of these and why you might put them in place. But you've got the capability to do all these things. Okay, if you've gone to Windows 10 already, you've got the capability, but have you actually thought about how you're going to enable them? Has that discussion been made? So the virtualization-based security. A lot of these technologies require virtualization-based security. So it will enable Hyper-V on your machine. And then a lot of these things happened in like secure containers, in these virtualized secure containers. Credential Guard's one, Device Guard's another. Parts of Edge, or Edge is also in the same scenario. So if you haven't even thought about, you know, enabling virtualization in your BIOS and enabling the Hyper-V platform, maybe not the management tools, they can create virtual machines, but at least the platform, then you've got the access to go and turn on all these other things. Secure boot. Hey, you know, going to secure boot means you could get rid of PIN. I don't know if you know why PIN is recommended, but between the time the machine starts and the time Windows actually runs, there is a period of time which someone could put a USB key in your machine, freeze the memory, grab the BitLocker key, and then take the drive out, put in another machine, you know, it would say, yes, I need to unlock it. Hey, I've got the key, right? So if someone steals your device, they've got plenty of time to spend, you know, trying to get the key between starting it and it actually Windows starting up. So the idea behind key, the PIN is, a user has to actually be there. They type in the PIN, okay, so there's actually a person present, and then they hit enter, and then there's that very short period of time where it would be very difficult for someone to come in and run that software on your machine before Windows starts. So it's not foolproof, and it could happen, but that's why PIN's there. But if you go secure boot, which on modern devices is possible, then no untrusted software can run while the machine is booting up. So those type of attacks are gone. That means you can get rid of that dreadful PIN. If you look at device guard, you've got AppLocker of old. Device guard's probably something new that we've done, which is probably much more efficient at blocking the type of things that AppLocker does. But that scenario where people click on that link and then it installs a bit of software in the user profile and it kind of leads to that past the hash attack, that's gone because only signed software can run on the machine. Okay, and up front, yeah, maybe that's a bit of work. But if you want to be in a scenario where only trusted software is run on your machines, you've got the ability to do that. And you might have specific scenarios in your environment where machines are very public facing, maybe you're in a bank and there's still PCs which are kind of sitting there, and maybe at the moment you kind of make sure that people can't get to USB keys or all kinds of things just to make sure that, you know, they can't do these type of things. You know, device guard could mean you don't even have to worry about it. You can let them use the USB keys because no untrusted software is going to run. It works on a synchronous kind of key pairing. No, it doesn't. Let me come back to that. It was Windows Hello for Business. Edge. Also, a lot of people we come and it's like, oh no, we're not doing Edge. IE is going to be the default. Why? Oh, just because we use IE. And really that is kind of walking into a room going, I have to paint it. And then you turn around and face the door and then you paint yourself into the corner. Okay, and then you realize, oh, I can't get out of this. You're continuing to put a lot of reliance on IE, and IE is only there to make sure that you've got backwards compatibility for some of those old apps that you've got in the environment. Also, Edge works on the basis that it's a Windows universal app. It is going to run in its own kind of sandbox environment. So there, anything that happens in that environment won't get leaked into the operating system. And when you close it down, everything is removed as far as, you know, exploits or vulnerabilities that could have been exploited, but it's retained in that virtualized kind of environment. So as far as browsers are concerned, and the enterprise, it is actually one of the most secure browsers that are out there. Yes, it may not work with all of your apps, but that's why we provide tools like Enterprise Site Discovery, which goes out and finds applications in your environment which may not work with the Edge engine, and it will tell you what mode you need to run it in. And then there's tools like Enterprise Site Mode, which will automatically kick you off to Internet Explorer, okay, and run the application in IE rather than Edge. So the user doesn't have to go, oh, okay, which browser do I use for this app? It will just automatically direct them. So the tools are there. Also, there's Cloud App Discovery. So if you're into a lot of the cloud services, Cloud App Discovery can be installed on machines, and that will actually start coming back and saying, oh, there's all these SaaS apps that you're using. Are you using, you know, you're using Slack? Oh, I didn't know we're using Slack. We're supposed to be using Microsoft Teams or whatever they've decided to call it. Credential Guard. This, like I said in the last session, is low-hanging fruit. Turn on the virtualization components in your BIOS, And it could be as simple as just turning on a group policy saying use credential guard. Now, yes, it can break things, and James will probably cover some of that. But automatically, all those kind of shared secret, those hashes that are in kernel memory are all put in that secure environment and are inaccessible to hackers. So again, we've kind of broken their playbook. Past the hash attacks are a lot less likely to occur. Windows information protection, the whole idea that I download something to my machine from some corporate service like Exchange or SharePoint or whatever service it might be, and as soon as I put it on my machine, it is secured because it's encrypted. It becomes like Microsoft, it's a Microsoft document, and it's encrypted with our keys, okay? And if I go and copy that onto a USB key, encryption remains with it. So you lose that USB key, I chuck it down the front and someone takes it and it's got some very sensitive information on it. That person is not a Microsoft person, so not going to be able to read it. With a bit of time and efforts and, you know, money, maybe they could break the encryption, but that's generally highly unlikely unless you've got someone that is very determined and has the resources to do it. But that's the same for basically any type of encryption. Then you get to Windows Hello for Business. So going away from the use of passwords. Maybe this is something that you want to get to. You know, passwords are so weak. You know, people will use the same password everywhere, right? So if you can find out what their password is for some random site which they don't care about, they probably use the same password for Facebook, and they probably use something similar for their banking. They might even use something, you know, very similar for logging on to the domain. So Windows Hello for Business is something which uses these asymmetrical key pairs, and you're basically setting up communication, secure communication between your device and the service, and there is no shared secret type passwords. You don't use a password anymore. Generally, you might use a PIN, but that PIN is assigned to a device. It doesn't carry around. Or, more secure, you might use biometrics. And biometrics like Windows Hello is something like one in, I can't remember what the term is, but it's like the possibility that your biometric footprint being confused with someone else's is like 1 in 100,000. Okay, and they also did a test in Australia with some kind of twin register. Okay, and you could probably do a search on that. And it was like, let's get twins in and we'll show that Windows Hello is not that great. And in all situations, twins would come in and it wouldn't allow the other twin to log on as the other twin. There were scenarios where it just wouldn't recognize either of them, but that was early. So, but there was no scenarios where the other twin would walk up and go, ah, yes. And since they use special devices like infrared cameras, you can't just take a picture and, you know, go and put it in front of the camera. You've got advanced spoofing type things where you can configure it to move your head, so you've got more of a three-dimensional type look. And then passwords are gone. It's easy for the user. You just stand in front of your machine and it logs on. And then it uses Windows Hello for Business to set up that secure communication using those key pairs. So you can just see that there's a lot of security components in there that often people just don't talk about. Maybe some of them haven't been released, or maybe you're not even aware of them. And the idea is if you're having these conversations, that you do look at least at the low-hanging fruit and make plans for some of the other ones based on the benefits that you can see. Even Windows Defender. Windows Defender has improved significantly. It actually turns off if you go and install your third-party AV. But if someone tries to remove it or the service stops, then Defender will kick back in. And so you're kind of always protected. Even if someone kind of gets through McAfee or whatever the case is, you know, that they could, you know, Defender will kick in. And apparently with 1607, periodically it will kick back in and just do a double check. So that's security. App compat, I said it's the same but different. We'll also cover Windows servicing. In the past, you had all your applications, you'd do a big discovery, you'd rationalize them down to a number of known apps. From there, you would assign tests, application owners and testers to every app. You'd get them to do rigorous testing, sign it all off, get the big green lights, and then you'd do your deployments. Now, because of Windows servicing and the fact that we're doing these feature updates and there's always the slim chance that a feature update could break something, you need to be relatively diligent about making sure that, okay, there is some testing process in place. But if you had to do that every time, you know, the same XP to Windows 7 migration, application compatibility testing, then you'd have a team testing all year round every year, right? So we need to change the way we do it. And it's all about risk-based application compatibility. Understanding this, we have to test, but we can't test everything. And so what we do is we find out what those critical line of business apps are, the ones that will have financial impact on the business if they are toast when you put the new feature update on. And for those apps, we do the original kind of full regression testing type thing, but you would hope that it's no more than 10% of your full application portfolio. The rest of the apps will be these supported applications. Now, supported apps it's more of a productivity advantage that people are getting, and if they don't work, then it's a productivity hit that's happening rather than financial impact. So you kind of group those off, and then you just have people testing as BAU. So when the next current branch of business comes out, you know, they get, you know, they're told that, yes, you're a tester, and then they just use it in their, you know, their daily work. Now, if there's issues, you can just roll them back. You know, there is a process to roll back. It used to be 30 days. It's only 10 days now. But it's just BAU testing. That's relatively easy. And we'll talk about how you might prepare for that going forward. And as far as the other ones, they're not supported. It's more reactive type testing. They're not supported by IT. Maybe you don't even want them in environments, and they are unwanted applications. But it's mainly those first two that you're concentrating on. That should be like 95% of your applications, with only about, you know, hopefully between 5 and 10% being those critical line of business, because then the testing maybe twice a year is relatively easy. And if you're doing application, like automated testing, it's a breeze. You don't have to worry at all. I've got customers that are doing that. This doesn't faze them. It's like, okay, it just gives us more opportunity to make sure we just do automated testing. Some customers, maybe you're a bit smaller, not possible, but generally you'll have less critical applications, and so the burden will be lighter as well. And then, you know, we're all familiar with this diagram, Windows as a Service, and there's engineering builds, and there's internal Microsoft flights, and there's the Insider program. You know, that's all about building Windows, and then it goes current branch for the consumers, and current branch for business, you know, which is aimed at the enterprise. And every time we've got more and more people testing, and based on the fact there's more and more people testing, we can find the issues and resolve the issues. But have you actually looked at how we're going to adopt it? You know, sometimes we do lip service to it, and we understand what it is, but do you know how you're going to adopt it? Do you know the processes that are going to have to be run in your environment to actually manage this on an ongoing basis and get into the rhythm? Okay, so if you went to Michael Niehaus's session, I would have assumed he would have talked about the rhythm. You need to get out into this rhythm because you are on this track, and there's gonna be no train wrecks, but you are on this track, and at some stage, you're going to have to get on to the next track. And if you leave it too late, you put a lot of pressure on yourself to get to that other track. So have you thought about who in the environment uses the Windows Insider program? You know, your developers, yes. Oh, sorry, I saw the hand go up. Oh, I've got a question. Have you thought about who's gonna be on the Windows Insider program? Maybe your developers or some people in the IT department. Who is gonna be on the current branch? Because you wanna identify the issues with your critical line of business apps as soon as possible. And you don't want to do that on the Windows Insider program because it's all over the place. You know, it starts out with a lot of features coming in and lots of bugs, and then they kind of get to a certain point where it's more bugs and less features. But, you know, things could change significantly, so testing there is probably not a good idea. Huh? Oh, the slow one, yeah, the slow one is pretty stable. Like, for instance, I'm on the fast. Pardon? Oh, she's here. We can talk about it later. So sometimes I come in and inject a dose of reality. No. I'm not a marketing person. I've got to deal with it on the front line. No. The slow one is much more reliable. Because if you're on the insider program and you get those little prompts from 1 to 5 and do a comment, they're actually very important. Because if they don't get enough 4 or 5s, and if she is here, she'll probably correct me. But they're very interested in those 4 or 5s. If they don't get enough of those, it doesn't reach a quality milestone, and then they can't go ahead. So if there's anything that you don't really like, just put, I wouldn't put 1, because they'd probably just think you're, but maybe put a 2 or 3 and then put a bit of a spiel about you know, something that you don't like. And it will come up and they will have to deal with it. But if you're always doing 5, 5, 5 or 1, 1, 1, then it's probably not going to be noticed as much. So we want to do that testing right up the front for the critical line of business apps. So if there is an issue, we've got, you know, at least 12 months to resolve it. Okay, obviously we'd kind of halt the rest of the rings from deploying, just so we can resolve the issue. But we want to test as early as possible. So you need to identify these users, you need to identify their devices. And on the next slide it talks about you need to have communication plans, because you want to let them know when these things are happening, so if issues come up, they know that they've got a feature update, and they can actually go through a process to go through to the applications team or through to specific people, so they can say, oh, hey, I know this new feature update's come out, and now I've got issues. Because if it doesn't go to people that know about this, it'll go to the help desk, and they'll go, oh, okay, and they'll try fix it, and they might put it to another level, and they'll try fix it, and they've spent half an hour, and then they go, all right, we'll trash your machine, and we'll just rebuild it. But it's still there, because it's the new feature update, right? So there needs to be these communication plans in place. There needs to be these identification of the people. There needs to be support processes in place. And a lot of people pay lip service to Windows as a service, but don't look at how they're going to adopt it. Who's on the current branch? How many rings do you have in the current branch for business? What are the delays between it being released and your first ring and your second ring? You know, a lot of times you want to make sure that those rings cover at least a month, maybe 6 weeks, because there might be some things that they only do once a month, and if the timing is wrong, maybe they're not going to find out that there are issues straight away. So these things all need to be taken into consideration. So this is why we spend so much time in those overview sessions talking about this. Otherwise, it can be just lip service. Okay, and it's not a linear thing. You don't kind of get to the end and start again. You've kind of got people, you'll have people doing CBB testing, and you'll have people on the Windows Insider program at the same time. So you've got to get into that rhythm. And I'll pass that. You know, looking at the platform that you've got, you know, are you doing Windows XP user state now? If you're still using Windows roaming profiles, I'm really sorry for you. And I'm not going to get you to raise your hand. But some people might, and there might be very good reasons. But it's not really good for a modern operating system. But this might be what user state virtualization looks for you. Roaming profiles, home drives, and shared network drives. And maybe you get to Windows 10 and that's exactly what you're still doing. Or maybe it's kind of getting to common user state now, which is folder redirection, a bit of folder redirection, home drive, shared drive, and maybe you're an MDOP customer. I don't think you have to be an MDOP customer now to use UEV, but you use UEV to capture those application settings and those OS settings and those Windows settings. So maybe that's where you're at. But have you had the discussion around the fact that there's things like enterprise state roaming, which can start taking your settings and putting them up into the cloud? Okay, it's secured by RMS, so it's secure when it's up there. It's where we're investing our efforts as far as user state virtualization. And then UEV is just for those Win32 apps. But then you look at the desktop, I can't remember, is it Desktop Creator? There is something that we've brought out, so I just can't remember the name off the top of my head, where we can turn an application which is a setup.exe type install into a Windows Universal app, and then carry on and use some of these new technologies. Maybe you've got a bit of folder redirection. Maybe you've got OneDrive for Business now and SharePoint. Maybe you're doing a bit of folder redirection to OneDrive for Business. Now, these are all considerations that you need to take into account if you're definitely heading in the cloud direction, and just understanding what is available out there. Or are you just going to go with what you always did and put up with, in many cases, the limitations of those products? Oh, yeah, no, none of them. I was told by some of our friends to try get my voice back that I had to kind of hum beforehand, and I needed to hum from low to high. And I'd get up so high, and then my voice would break, and then I'd just go down a bit, and that's where I talk, so my voice wouldn't do that. But obviously, I started going a bit higher. No, nothing is kind of at this stage going to be unsupported. It's just a matter of whatever works best for your situation. But the thing is, a lot of people don't take into account some of the new technologies. So what we're trying to do is just make sure you've had that conversation, you've taken it into consideration. Maybe you've gone, I want to go Azure Active Directory. I'm not going to join my machines to AD. But you've got all these legacy apps. Sometimes the marketing can, be a bit deceptive. But if you've got lots of legacy apps which all use, NTLM and Kerberos, and you're just connecting a machine to Azure Active Directory and using a different authentication method, how does your machine authenticate with all those legacy apps? So then you've got to start thinking about, okay, now we've got to cloudify all our applications. We've got to find all these other ways to give users access to them. So it's like, okay, make sure you've qualified some of these decisions that you might have decided to do. Sometimes you can look at that middle one and go, oh yes, okay, it sounds perfect. That's where we want to be. It's just all clear. And that might be good for someone that is just using productivity tools, Office 365, perfect, absolutely perfect. And I've got customers who have are doing that as a specific component. Have you looked at, okay, we've got Config Manager. We could just integrate it with Intune, and then we can manage all our devices. As far as MDM is concerned and application management and make sure we put compliance in, these are all considerations that you take. Now, they might not be part of the Windows 10 project, but it could be part of that roadmap to getting to kind of the end state where you want to be as far as your environment is concerned. What about Windows Store for Business? Have you taken in consideration how you could use that and how it integrates with Config Manager? And are there line of business applications you could be creating now, and they could go into your store and be delivered by the store? Have these questions been asked? Training. For me, if people aren't more productive just by using the OS at the end of the project, for me it's a bit of a failure. Okay, I've kind of failed in making sure that people, the amount of people that I see clicking, like even Windows 10, start, and then they start scrolling through the big all apps, and it's huge. And they finally get down to Y, and they click their app, and then it opens up, and that took, about 7-8 seconds just to get to that one app. And they do that for every app, right? They don't know how to pin to the taskbar. They don't know how to pin to start. They don't know that they could have just they had their hands on the keyboard. They could have just hit Windows key and type Y, whatever the next, and then it's there, and they could hit enter, and that takes a second. Or snapping, just throwing things off into the corners. And, I was on a plane just recently, and I, with my finger, just snapped things into four corners. I was watching a video, taking notes on it, and I was also writing it. So I was doing all these things at the same time because I could just throw them into the corners. And I did that in a session with some other people. Oh, you can do that. Oh, wow. And these are people that are using Windows 7 where you could snap, right? So training is important. You're going to have different types of people. Some people are going to be early adopters and the likes. Some are going to be a bit more difficult to train, but you need to think about, how you're going to do the training, what resources are available, and those big old, let's put them in a room for 40 minutes when they get their PC, just don't work. So what we tend to do is we send them all these kind of familiarization emails out, talking about all these new features that they've got, and then they kind of, on the day, they kind of and these might happen on an ongoing basis. Then on the day, they get maybe a quick reference guide. And then afterwards, they continue to get these tips and tricks. So they kind of, I can do that right at the beginning. And then they get their quick reference guide, and yes, I remember that now. I read it in that email before. And then 6 weeks later, they get another email and go, oh yeah, that's right. And you're basically solidifying the fact that they can use these things to be more productive. And having a plan. Now, I'm just going to jump over this because I need to give James an opportunity to talk about NZT. So deployment approaches. Are you just automatically going to do wipe and load? or have you taken into consideration that if you're in the scenario where you just want to get to Windows 10 as quickly as possible, and there's nothing stopping you from doing that, that you could do an in-place upgrade? Maybe you've got certain scenarios where dynamic provisioning could work, but there are limitations, and you need to understand what those limitations are, and I just don't have time to talk about that today, but feel free to come up and talk to me. As far as deploying Windows, you know, rather than looking at all these considerations, yes, we've just made the decision to do wipe and load because that's what we're familiar with, and not taken into the fact that if none of those considerations apply to you, we could actually do an in-place upgrade. So, you know, the zero scenario is, okay, I'm going from Windows 7 to Windows 10, and I probably want all these technologies. I know I want all those technologies. And if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to do a wipe and load. Okay, but it's going to be a relatively big project. But for them, it was, oh, yeah, we want to do Windows 10. I can get a subset of these technologies. I'll do an in-place upgrade now to get to Windows 10 as quickly as possible. And then as I go and, you know, machines have issues, and the first thing we say is, oh, go to Windows 10 and it'll all be gone. Might be the case, might not be the case, but, you know, it's the line you can use. And maybe, like I said, provisioning might be an option. But you could take that as an approach, or maybe you've got Windows 8 and Windows 7. Windows 8 is so up to date, secure boot is already done, there's no kind of things that are preventing you from doing in-place upgrade. So the in-place upgrade on those, get you there faster for a you know, proportion of your fleet. And then the Windows 7, so you've got all these options that you need to take into consideration. And without further ado, James from New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. Thank you, give him a hand.
Hi, thanks. So yeah, I'm gonna take a few minutes just to go through our deployment at NZT. I was the technical lead on the deployment. First a little bit about NZTE. So we're a Crown entity, which means that we have an independent board, but they're basically set up by the government. About 4,000 customers, primarily obviously using businesses. There's probably a few of you out there that are companies that deal with NZTE. 550 staff, half in New Zealand, half in international offices, give or take. A mixture of standalone locations and offices run out of the embassies, and some of our offices run consulates for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So I'm going to rattle through this. This is a lovely map of our offices, so it's probably worth mentioning the logistical overhead of actually getting the devices to all these places. So big shout out to the pilot project team that did that, because that was definitely half the battle. So some numbers, so yeah, 48 locations, 10 of which are within New Zealand, the rest are international, and 600 plus devices deployed. So every single site, every single person got a Windows 10 device. Six hardware models, we were very lucky in that the majority of our fleets, of 80-90% were ready for retirement, so we had a great opportunity to start fresh. The remainder were less than a year old, so they still had all the functionality available for some of the advanced features that Brendan's been talking about. And the entire length of the project was 3 months, and that was from sort of first meeting with Brendan and all the way through to the last Windows 10 device going on someone's desk. So pretty aggressive rollout, but worked reasonably well. So some decisions that we had to make pretty early on. So one of the first ones was to upgrade to SCCM 1511, which was still relatively new at the time. A couple of reasons for that. One was to get the new software center, because we really wanted to leverage the user targeted applications and all in one place in the nice new software center. The second one was really to get Windows 10 servicing up and running. When we were deploying 1511, the anniversary edition was already on the horizon, and we wanted to sort of make sure that we were starting as we meant to go on and sort of starting to get comfortable with that idea. Microsoft's recommendation, we used a separate MDT environment to create the Windows 10 WIM. So the idea behind that was really to have a repeatable process for the inevitable feature releases of Windows 10 over the following year. So that's worked pretty well. We've already used it to create our anniversary edition WIM, and it has saved a lot of pain. I mean, the days of having a single Windows 7 WIM and just doing offline servicing for updates and doing that forever for 3 years is over. So being able to recreate a WIM really easily was a benefit. I'm not going to talk about, you know, the benefits of a larger WIM versus putting everything in the tar sequence, and we sort of ended up somewhere in the middle. And then the three sort of security features listed there, Obviously, new hardware, we wanted to take advantage of the fact that we were doing a brand new deployment. Now, I'm sure not everyone's going to have that luxury, but we really wanted to take advantage of all, as Brendan said, the low-hanging fruit from a security perspective. And USMT, really, I'm sure most of you have used USMT for deployment before. Pretty standard. In our case, we had a few extra bits for some NZT-specific software, but one interesting thing worth mentioning was we ended up deploying a part of the USMT script for discovery early on, so we ended up having a pretty good understanding of how much data in each of the locations we had to migrate, so that worked pretty well. So internally, we had to change a few processes to support Windows 10 in the environment, so we're generally pretty good at deploying updates for Windows 7 back in the day, but we put in an ADR for the Office of Windows Updates just to sort of get the ball rolling every patch Tuesday. We've also increased the size of the pilot group, so we've now got probably twice the people doing the initial sort of update testing in various offices around the world. We deployed Gen 1 hardware, so one of the devices we deployed was actually still being built in the factory when we started the project. I think we didn't see it until about 2 weeks in. So inevitably, there were BIOS updates for bug fixes and performance improvements. So we've had to become really good at deploying BIOS and driver updates remotely. We actually started deploying devices only 3 weeks in. So anything that we changed later on the project had to be retrofitted back to those things that were already out. Testing, again, we had testing processes, but we had to really ramp those up. There's a whole new OS, new software suite rolled out, Office 2016. Everything was new. We had a great test manager who worked very closely with the project team. We had really good pilot users, most of which provided feedback. That was obviously half the battle of all the time to actually understand what was going on, especially sort of as we went through the project and had more and more people overseas using the devices. And really, it was getting everyone used to the change of pace. So as Brendan's mentioned on a couple of occasions, you're on this track, and the days of having a single sort of task sequence with a WIMU update once in a blue moon is sort of over. You have to be comfortable with updating your WIM, updating your task sequence, making sure that your technical staff are prepared to deploy and manage new releases of Windows, and it's the same for the users as well to a lesser degree. Like they have to be a bit more prepared to see the new features in the anniversary edition when they come out, slight UI changes, stuff like that. So we've made a bit of an effort to try and get NZT staff to understand how Windows is changing. And last of all, for a couple of seconds, a couple of lessons learned. So we deployed a hybrid device, and I'm sure most of you by now have deployed Windows to a device without a network adapter. Couple of gotchas we found with regards to device discovery and reusing the same network adapters. So we ended up finding a registry key in SECM which allowed you to set a MAC address to avoid it for discovery, which is very useful. So there's a good tip there. Obviously, lining up Windows 10 with our 2012 R2 servers, SMB3 was in the mix, and we rely heavily on WAN optimization at NZT due to the distributed nature of the offices. Our WAN optimizers weren't quite ready for SMB3, so we had to do a bit of work to understand what was happening and remediate that. And last of all, credential guards. So, an amazing feature and relatively easy to implement. It is just a couple of group policies and a few BIOS settings, but as Brendan mentioned before, you do have to work closely with your applications team because it does, it does have some impact. It quite rightly drops support for older NTLM and unconstrained Kerberos delegation. So luckily we weren't caught out too badly, but a few sort of smaller apps were definitely impacted by that. So I would just say, if you've got dedicated applications teams, make sure you work closely with those guys. And so I think really in summary, the deployment was generally a success. I think it was well worth us, taking the extra effort at the beginning to understand how Windows had changed and, get ready for Anniversary Edition, even though it wasn't, even a set date at that point. Now that it's out and we're starting to test it with our pilot users, we're much happier that we sort of got ourselves into a good position early on and prepared for the future changes. So there you go.
Some people might leave, that's fine. I just want to quickly touch on Xero because this is important for you to understand, because that was a traditional type deployment. Obviously, most people will be familiar with Xero. As far as, you know, started in 2006, lots of staff across the world, 15 countries, or 14 cities across four countries. They chose the in-place upgrade because it was kind of the easiest and least disruptive to the users. It was within a few hours they had a task sequence to do it. So, you know, as far as effort that went into it, there was limited effort. Their machines were relatively up to date, so it wasn't like there was a big application or configuration drift that they had to worry about. They didn't really have any incompatible apps, and it didn't take them much to just program something into Config Manager to remove them or update them. And they had a lot of SaaS apps since they were a very young company. They had a lot of SaaS apps, and because of that, they didn't really have to worry about many of those apps. They were very heavy on self-service, and really, we were just talking to one of the Xero guys here, their deployment was viral. So they said, okay, right, so we're going to get people to do self-service in-place upgrades, and they got a pilot of about 100 within a few weeks, and then that quickly grew to the point where, you know, just a few months later, they're at 90% deployment, and they haven't forced anyone to do it. So it's just like, you know, if you want to do it, you just go into Software Center and you click a button and it will start the process. But when someone gets it and all of a sudden they've got Windows 10 and they can do all these other things and maybe they've got a nice device or whatever the case is, and then the other person kind of goes, well, actually, that means there is no people that are going out and, you know, hand-holding or something like that. And maybe your environment, that might not work just because some of the people are in there, but there might be scenarios where it may work. So it's definitely something to take into consideration. They really simplified things like the image and group policy. They limited UI restrictions, and the feedback was, it doesn't feel like you're restricting us, it feels like you're just letting us do our work. Now, they didn't make everyone local admins, but they gave everyone self-service so they could go do things themselves. And then they thought they were local admins because they could just go, oh yeah, I want that, click, and it would install. So definitely, in many ways, a viral implementation of Windows, and the efforts that went into it. I was on a 3-week POC that went over about 9 weeks. I would show the guys how things worked. I would go away for 3 days. They would put it all into production. I'd come back, do something else, they'd put it in production. Halfway through, they were doing their pilots. And by the time I finished, I'd done 700 out of the 1,500. And now they're at 90%. And the whole idea was they were creating things in parallel for images, for new machines, and machines that needed to be rebuilt, okay? And what they did is, okay, if a machine is having problems, we'll rebuild it with, you know, the new image for Windows 10. Or if new machines come in, it will get Windows 10. So that was just their approach. And then they could enable some of those new features there. So you can just see the capabilities that are there and the things that you need to take into consideration if you're embarking on this journey. So make sure that you're having those conversations, whether it's with your IT team or whether it's with your partners, to make sure you're getting full value of Windows 10. Thank you for your time.